uncertainty, precarity, and chaos that we were trying so hard to provide sanctuary to.
And so Rosemary, I wanted to ask you, because we only have about a minute left, but if you could talk about the connection to George Floyd, to many of the residents in the hotel. He actually worked for a time in one of the city's major homeless shelters, and many of the residents there knew him. Could you talk about that as well?
Yeah. George Floyd was a shelter worker. He worked at the largest shelter in town for about 3 years. A number of the people that were staying in the Sheridan, or the former Sheridan, knew him. There's a resident here that was present when he was murdered by the police. And George Floyd is the person that gave us the power to make these opportunities happen. We have an obligation to create the world that we want to live in. We've been seeing that it's a possibility. It took burning down a police station to convince the county that we needed to open up some more options, and it still wasn't enough. It's clear that people still have nowhere to go. It is clear that the crisis is much larger than anything that's been measured. And right now we are at a crisis point. We're calling upon the state, the county, the city, the nonprofits, the entire system to step in. These people have nowhere to go now. This is a dangerous situation. It's been a dangerous situation. People are dying much younger than they should be. They were already facing epidemic infectious disease prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. They're already facing epidemic overdose deaths with massive racial disparities. Native people being 20 times more likely to be homeless than white Minnesotans. People who are indigenous to...
And we've just run out of time at KBOO Portland. You can hear the end of Democracy Now! At democracynow.org. Right now, we've got the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with your hosts, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris, coming up, so stay tuned.
Hey, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
We're okay, and it's raining, and there's a lot to talk about, and some very good ideas are coming out of the movement against police brutality and police aggression. And we do need to touch on that. I want to remind people you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM on your FM dial here in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. And you can call us, actually talk to us at 231-8187.
Yeah, we should point out that right now we're experiencing the largest mass economic dislocation since the Great Depression, the largest pandemic since the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918, mm-hmm. and also the most widespread social unrest we've seen in many, many years. So, yeah, interesting time to be alive, certainly.
It is an interesting time to be alive. I would much prefer to be like 25 and alive right now.
Is that just because of the circumstances, or is that just sort of a standing wish you have?
Well, it's probably more like a silly standing wish. I just, I would like to be much more spry and active and leaping to the fore and all kinds of romantical ideas like that. Because, in fact, this is... really a very exciting time with a great deal of potential for change that really needs to happen.
Oh, absolutely, indeed. However, there might be a silver lining for you, and that is that it's really not safe to go out there and join these mass protests. I understand why it's happening. I'm glad that it's happening. I understand why people are choosing to demonstrate, and I'm glad they are choosing that. But there's many people who simply can't make that choice because either they or somebody they live with is immunocompromised and simply can't afford to be exposed to COVID-19. So I hope that those people out there protesting don't necessarily judge people who have stayed at home too harshly, because for some people, they just can't make that choice.
Oh, that's good. That's sweet. I like that.
It's true. It's true.
No, it is
absolutely true.
It is absolutely true. And in fact, what I have seen all over the country, including Portland, is very exciting, more exciting than even my very long ago experiences against the war in Vietnam, against the bomb, and against racial inequity from way back. So this is an interesting and possibly, potentially very good time. However, the president of the United States, sorry, I can't help but laughing. He seems to be afraid of the people. He has put up an incredible fencing around the existing fencing around the White House. And the fence is fine steel, black, of course, and then at the very top is razor wire. So that did you know that?
Yeah, I did hear about that. Yeah, I'm glad our tough guy president feels nice and safe. That's good.
Well, he's very safe, and then he's got all these guys with AK-47s and whatnot behind the fence, ready to mow down the crazy people who, until he came along, were the citizens of the United States. So this is an important revelation. The cowardice of this man, the fear of the man, the image of him huddled in his bunker, the reality of his denial of everything that is humane and democratic in our society becomes even more significant, not just because of the virus, but in fact because of what's going on with the discovery that most people in communities of color and many poor people, both groups, have known for a long, long time. And I'm going to, even from my position of relative privilege, want to talk about some of my experiences with the police and here in Portland, Oregon, and in New York. And what I have seen, all of it, points to the idea that we need to change the way in which we provide safety for our public.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, please continue.
Well, just to begin with, the creation of public policing was always a way of knocking back new immigrants, having a posse at a crossroads to capture escaped slaves, or even just hapless black people going about their business without a document to prove that they were okay. And in fact, that whole tradition of posses and protections and devices to control also includes the tradition of policing to destroy organized labor and other things. And I would like to just spend a couple of minutes in Portland history, if I may, because it's important to understand the history of police in this town. They were not a respected agency for much of our earlier history. When in the later years, post-war years, the police attempted to form a labor union, they didn't get anywhere. The Portland Docks Association, all the various elements of the shipping trade, didn't want the organization of the dock workers. They didn't want the organization of that. When they had that, and it became powerful and it became famous after disasters in the 1930s in San Francisco and elsewhere, when it became that, it became a very powerful labor union. The ILWU, the International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union, became a significant, largely a liberal left organization that supported hardworking men and women on the docks. At that time, at the same time, a little bit after the organization of the ILWU, the Portland police wanted to become unionized. And they were getting nowhere. But the ILWU people pointed out that in their contract with the docks in Portland, in those days there were two places where shipping took place, in those docking places, the fact of the matter was that they had to allow, the bosses had to allow informational picketing, and that the union, the ILWU, would not cross a legitimate unionized picket line, period. When that was relayed to the police, they put out informational pickets at every entry point to the docks. And the result was to absolutely close down the port of Portland. And the result of that, the support of the working men and women of the ILWU, created enough power, enough pressure, that in fact the police were effectively unionized. And this was initially, and I think an important thing, a good thing. Now, what has happened since then historically to police everywhere is they have become not just unionized, but an advocacy group for the police, right or wrong. And that I've seen in Portland, Oregon many, many times. In my own experience, being an activist for some time, being privileged and white, to my own, I have to say it, surprise, I have had conflict with the police. I have been arrested, roughed up, thrown in jail twice on totally bogus things. And just twice, just twice.
You are kind of cantankerous.
No. Actually, I'm really carefully polite in those situations.
Oh, no, it's really, in those situations.
Okay. Yeah. Not just like you and I. You know, I'm cantankerous with you and I or on the air. But the fact of the matter is, my goal has always been a commitment coming out of nonviolent efforts that I learned from a long time, beginning in 1960, all the way through time in New York, working with Dorothy Day and others, that in fact is very important, because I believe in nonviolence and I believe in the presentation of self, not as an aggressor, but as a firmly committed individual toward the right and proper things. And occasionally those lead to situations where the police, for political reasons, following the leadership of the city government or somebody else or themselves, have found me an inconvenient obstacle. And as such an obstacle, I'm rather easily removed. And that's what has been my experience. Fortunately, that has only happened in terms of arrests twice. And both times, the charges were pure bull.
I think you found your epitaph, an inconvenient obstacle.
Yeah, you know, like, hey, you shouldn't do that, or hey, these people got a right to be here, or whatever. I mean, I got involved in Lair Hill Park in a police beatdown of a motorcycle gang, and I objected to what they were doing there. As a result of that, a few hours after that, when my partner and I were on the way, actually, to a classical music concert, was that I was arrested for carrying a concealed weapon. The weapon wasn't concealed. It was a regular knife, a knife I bought at Norm Thompson. It was a totally bogus thing. I was arrested. I was thrown in the back of a police car. It was an experience that I would not seek again. The next time that I was arrested was a few years later, when I was trying to save some trees at Portland State. In both cases, I had not committed a crime. In both cases, the action of the police was arbitrary and in the interest, basically, of the ruling classes as they perceived it.
I think you've hit on something very important there, and that is, I think, on balance, writ large, throughout the history of policing in the United States, police forces have existed to support the interests of the ruling class.
Absolutely. The property classes,
yeah. And you talked about how the pseudo-military organization of our law enforcement agencies is modeled after the fugitive slave patrols from the Old South. And that is correct. And that racial dimension has never left policing in the United States either. If you consider the 20th century phenomenon of white flight from urban centers in the United States out to the suburbs and the exurbs, which resulted in the de facto segregation of many major cities across the country. Most of those white people, regardless of their political bent, were content, gave their tacit approval to the sort of oppressive tactics that police would employ against communities of color, because they believed that those tactics made their own communities safer. Now, there's a whole lot of assumptions baked into that notion. But it's true. It is true in the end that white people, the majority of white people in this country for many, many decades, have given their tacit approval to oppressive state violence being inflicted upon the bodies of people of color because they believed it made them safer. I contend that is a fundamentally erroneous belief, and that if we have a ruling class that is willing to use those sorts of tactics, then nobody in the end is safe.
Well, and there was a famous, a very obvious and famous event in 1970 at Portland State, where the police tactical squad, itching to get a chance to use its force, which was powerful, smashed into a group of students, did not arrest, as far as I can tell, anybody, but beat on people very severely. Now, they were careful. They did not kill anyone. They were dealing largely with white people, and they were dealing with a student mob, and that is a privileged class. But it was nevertheless a punishment to students who dared to oppose the order of things in the Vietnam War.
Mm. You know, I've witnessed some of this stuff myself, too. I recall one of the first major demonstrations I took part in Portland was in early 2001. George W. Bush paid a visit to downtown Portland. I don't know if you recall that.
Oh,
things
I remember.
Things got a little bit rowdy.
Well, I got gassed in that event.
I got some sort of pepper spray shrapnel. I didn't get it full in the face, but I got splashed with it, which was bad enough. I don't care to be hit full in the face with pepper spray. But I was part of a group that splintered off from the main group and sort of made its way down to the foot of the Morrison Bridge on Alder Street in Southwest Portland. There was a cordon of police there preventing us from marching onto the bridge. So this group sort of milled about for a second and then organized itself and turned around to head back the way it had come, only to discover that a line of police had encircled the entire gathering in the intersection. And they ordered us to move. They said, "You've got to clear this intersection." So
that's called
here we had a situation where we were being ordered to move by the police, but that meant that any movement necessarily would cause us to cross their lines, right? Because they had us hemmed in. So the group formed up again and started moving back to the west. And as soon as they crossed the police line, the police opened up with pepper spray. This was where, if you remember, spray painted around town for years afterwards, you used to see they pepper sprayed babies. That was the incident right there. I was right next to that couple whose toddler got hit with pepper spray. So this was an incident of the police. directing a crowd to behave in a certain way and then ensuring that they're able to punish that crowd for following their own directive.
Well, and what's interesting about what's happened right now, as a result of the horrific behavior of the police in several locations, most notable Minneapolis, is that people are beginning to rethink the notion of how you build a safety system in a city or in a county or in a state. Cities like Compton, which used to be the main center for African American youth culture at one point, and Camden, New Jersey, have all adopted systems where if you call 911, instead of just automatically getting the police, you can say what your problem is. They will send, if it's appropriate, an ambulance, even a counselor. Only a policeman or a policewoman, if absolutely clearly what is needed. There is under that system no knock warrants. There is no system there of an assumption to kill. And remember, during the period of time, going back even further, during the days of the Black Panthers, it was customary for the police to burst in on people and kill them. I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah, indeed.
Kill them.
Now, we need to point out something it's the elephant in the room here, but we need to point it out nonetheless, and that is, you and I have been describing our run-ins with the police and the observations of their destructive and negative behavior, and all of that is true, but this pales in comparison to the price borne by communities of color
for
literally
centuries. I'm a white guy. That's an enormous advantage in a racist society.
It is an enormous advantage in a racist society, because here's what white people by and large don't have to endure at the hands of the police, and that's wanton violence and death. I was looking at some statistics on this yesterday, and since 2005, the share of police homicides that have fallen upon African Americans and Latino people accounts for 3/4 of all the police caused fatalities in the country. 3/4. So state violence is falling overwhelmingly upon the heads of people of color, and that's not a recent development, and that's why the televised murder of George Floyd was finally the thing that pushed tensions past the boiling point. And I don't think we can ignore in the current context the fact that this is all happening during a global health crisis.
Which was incompetently handled by the administration.
That was incompetently handled by the administration, absolutely. So now we are in the situation where we're in, where we're seeing this wonderful outpouring of support for the victims of state violence in the United States. And in places you would never expect. I mean, 1,000 people in Medford turned out and surrounded the courthouse there and stayed for 12 hours. We've had protests in Baker City, in Prineville, in Monmouth, and all of these places in deep red parts of Oregon. People are turning out, you know, in the hundreds and in the thousands to support George Floyd and all the other victims of police violence in the country. And these demonstrations are being echoed around the world. It is truly an extraordinary moment we're living in.
And while it is certainly true that a person of color is at incredible disadvantage in this system, just as working people were at an incredible disadvantage when they tried to organize and unionize and got shot and beat up by the police, we now know that it is possible to uncouple general safety issues from policing. And the actual policing involving robbers and violent criminals and so on is a very small part of what is needed for public safety. So when people say, you know, let's defund the police, they're not talking about let's create some kind of weird system where there's no law and order. They're saying, look, let's put policing in its place. It's a very small part of what we do to protect our communities, actually. And much larger is the issues of people who have gotten into terrible trouble for drug abuse, for psychotic episodes, for being homeless, for having illnesses, for having domestic disputes and so on. All these things best handled by people who are trained to de-escalate, to be generous, to be kind, to help people get back into a situation where they're not in the horrible hands of people who are armed with guns and clubs and handcuffs and see every citizen as a potential criminal.
Yeah, you're right. And as you just mentioned, it's based on a very simple premise, which is not every emergency is a question of the breaking of laws. Not every emergency requires the response of law enforcement officers or requires violence or the potential of violence as a solution. In fact, the vast majority do not require any of those things. What people in Compton and in Camden and now in Minneapolis, we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, are calling for is an expanded concept of emergency response, of which enforcing the law is only a small fraction. The idea being that instead of more cops on staff, instead of more cops you know, being gifted with more and more military-grade equipment, what we need is instead counselors, therapists, addiction specialists, mental health crisis specialists, people who are able to respond with the right kind of expertise in the right kind of situation. And just taking that simple step de-escalates the possibility of violence from the very beginning.
It should be the main idea of public safety in general.
Yes, and it seems like that is an idea whose time has come. It's that old saw, right? In a crisis, all of a sudden, all things are possible. And we're seeing that right now. Here's what the a statement issued by a majority of members of the Minneapolis City Council says about this subject. It's a pretty profound statement. Decades of police reform efforts have proved that the Minneapolis Police Department cannot be reformed and will never be accountable for its actions. We are here today to begin the process of ending the Minneapolis Police Department and creating a new transformative model for cultivating safety in our city. We recognize that we don't have all the answers about what a police-free future looks like, but our community does. We're committing to engaging with every willing community member in the city of Minneapolis over the next year to identify what safety looks like for everyone. We'll be taking intermediate steps towards ending the MPD through the budget process and other policy and budget decisions over the coming weeks and months. So there it is. The city of Minneapolis is getting rid of its police department. And we need to underscore here that they're not getting rid of its law enforcement function or capacity. They are siding together to address emergencies in different ways.
Well, and the reality is that the police, in many situations, in many places, including Portland, Oregon, one of the whitest towns in the world, the fact of the matter is that the police are often the aggressor. They're often the people who shove down the door. They're often the people who don't want to hear an explanation. They're often the people who are anxious to put other people in chains. And this, again, is out of that tradition, going way, way back, a tradition that essentially is against working people, against African-Americans, against Hispanics, against, at one point, against the Irish. The fact of the matter is that if you are a minority in any sense, or a person who needs services in any sense, you are easily subject to the authoritarian approaches of angry men, mostly men and a few women, who should not be the people to come to help you.
Yes, that's all true, but I feel we need to take it a little bit deeper. Yes, minorities of all sorts are vulnerable, but in particular, if you're somebody whose skin tone immediately sets you off as a member of a minority community, you are especially at risk. And that, those are the facts. Those are the inescapable facts of life in the United States.
Yep.
Speaking of,
so yeah,
well, let's remember about 20 minutes ago when you gave out the studio phone, the air room phone number.
Uh-huh.
Well, a couple people have called and are trying to join the conversation.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Okay. Do we still have Robbie?
Yeah.
Okay. You go ahead, Robbie. You're live.
Good morning. Hey, I love what you brought up. I got to say, you know, everything you brought up, the slave patrols, that's where the police come from. It's amazing watching just how brainwashed, I don't want to say brainwashed is the right word, but just ingrained that we need the police. But I have to say this past, you know, week and a half of straight protesting hitting the streets has gotten so much done. People are questioning why we have the police. That's amazing. I wanted to give some stuff, just some pointers for when we're addressing people who don't understand, you know, why it is we want to dismantle the police. And one of those points being, you know, you went over it really well. But, you know, for instance, we have the authoritarian idea that police always have this gun. And that makes a lot of people, you know, nervous, particularly, you know, people of color. There was this horrible incident 2 years ago. Cassandra, I don't know her name, but Cassandra Leia, she was a black woman, pregnant. Her house was robbed. She called the police. The police showed up and shot her, shot and killed her in front of her three kids. And so, you know, the police aren't safe for certain people. And that's where the root cause of what you're getting at here. But I wanted to say, you know, having this idea for when people are like, you know, trying to, you know, debate, you know, wait, who's going to protect me? You know, or how can we not have the police? You know, you said it, you know, we need to be, instead of giving, you know, cops tanks and rocket propelled grenade launchers, you know, we need to be hiring doctors. We need to be hiring psychiatrists. We need to be hiring people who can, you know, community-based people who can save and help the community. And they're the first responders, not somebody with a gun. That's going to just make paranoid people more scared. But, you know, I'll take just one more point, but the traffic, why don't we just have traffic monitors? You know, all the time I'll hear the Blue Lives Matter people say, oh, well, you know, I pulled over this car and, you know, I didn't know, but it could have been my last time, you know, that I pulled over because whatever crazy scenario, you know, happens when you have a guy with a gun pulling over somebody else. But if you had a traffic monitor, not a cop, not a police officer with a gun pulling over people, but just somebody to, you know, give out tickets for speeding, you know, traffic accidents, pulling over people for running red lights, that thing, but they're not a cop. They don't have a gun. Imagine the scenario when you pull over somebody and let's say they are that, you know, deranged, crazy person that would have killed a cop. You're just a traffic monitor and you try to pull over somebody and they take off and run away. They don't have to chase them. You know, nobody has to die. Nobody has to get killed. You know, they just track the license plate, you know, figure out what to do. And then they can call somebody with the appropriate, you know, I don't know, weapon, with the appropriate thing whenever it gets escalated to that. But it's just so backwards the way that we're doing it, because right now it's like we're sending the police officer and then the police officer gets to determine if they're going to, you know, call in for psychiatric help or whatever they call those crisis teams. But it should be the other way around. But anyway, I just loved everything you brought up. And ultimately, the reason why this is so important to me is because I believe we're going to be in a really critical debate. You know, I'm pretty critical of liberals, but right now, liberals are trying to pass a they're trying to debate for reform, and any civil rights activist will tell you reform does not work. Taking a knee with cops is, first of all, you know, it was a knee taking it was a cop taking a knee that killed George Floyd. But third of all, you know, second of all, the police forces across the nation taking a knee. I have no idea what that is, but that's a PR stunt by the police. And if they're going to be like, oh, we'll just reform, that's not good enough. So we need to completely uproot the racism. And I just loved everything you brought up. I just wanted to share that. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah, I agree. I'm suspicious of those gestures of solidarity.
Well, I want to use an example from Portland that I've seen over and over again. The police do something horrible. There was an African-American woman who got very upset and tried to get away from the police in a police, I think in a police car, and she was shot dead. And the argument the police made was it endangered police officers when she was trying to escape. In order
That was Kendra James.
I couldn't remember her name. In order, and that's a shame too, in order to deal with that, they immediately organized an event at a major African-American church. And then when angry people, many of whom had never been in that particular church and had no particular tradition of that church, were angry, the response was, well, you're in a church now. You can't be angry. You can't express your rage. And if it had happened once, it would have been disgusting. But I have seen it happen more than once. It's the way in which the police manipulate the religious community to control the behavior of persons of color in a situation where the police are, in fact, dangerous, in fact, murderers in some cases.
Yeah, that's true. And I'd like to inject a little something else into this conversation, too, that I think has been overlooked since these protests broke out over the last couple of weeks. And that is, before George Floyd was murdered, about a week previous, there was that young man in Georgia, Ahmaud Arbery, who was hunted down and killed by two white men because he was out jogging and he bore a superficial resemblance to somebody the police had been looking for. Now, the reason I mention this is that when we're talking about racial violence in the United States, the problem of state violence in the form of the police is a horrible problem and a systemic one. But almost as often, if not more so, over history, black folks have found themselves the subject of attack from white citizens, not police, but everyday people. And this goes on and on and on. The history is there. I encourage you to go and learn more about it. It's not just police that folks of color have had to fear in this country, but private white citizens. And that's a factor in all of this as well.
Well, and I think the custom of lynching, the custom of extra-legal murder of persons who have somehow violated some rule or taboo or whatever, or are rumored to have done something wrong, is super common. It was something that for years and years and years, the NAACP fought to get a federal law against lynching. Never did. I don't believe it ever did happen until the Civil
War. No, it's just recently spelled out. It just recently spelled out in the Senate. Thanks to Senator Rand Paul.
Oh, don't let me commence on Rand Paul.
Very well, we shan't commence on that. We've got a couple more folks waiting, and I'm going to prime everything by calling back to something you said earlier, Abe. About 3/4 of all police-caused fatalities are on people of color. And I want to say something about statistics, especially national statistics. Local jurisdiction is actually required to provide statistics to the Department of Justice or the Bureau of Labor of Prison. It's anything. And not only are they not required to provide anything, when they do provide, they get to choose what statistics they provide, what reports they provide to the FBI for their crime stats. So we are only getting the picture that whatever local jurisdictions choose to participate, choose to present.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, let that sink in for a little bit here. In the United States of America, police fatality statistics don't have to be officially reported. whenever we talk about them, it's because of the work of independent fact-finding groups who've gone and dug this stuff up. It's astonishing.
Well, I remember the, looking back to the 60s, remember the Black Panthers and how coming out of Oakland, they were making a response to repeated police abuses. They didn't happen out of thin air. It wasn't something made up. It was real. And that led, in fact, to many reprisals, several of them murders in several different cities, murders of Black men and women, in fact, without any warrants, without any legitimacy, with the support of the FBI, with the support of the system. And it was all, they're scary and we killed them.
Right.
And on that note, there are a couple of other folks who are waiting to join in the conversation. Is Mike still with us?
Yeah, hi, KBOO.
Go ahead, Mike, you're live.
Hey, what's on your mind?
Well, there's a lot of great info and discussion, and I the suggestions of local responders, or not responders, but just watch people working for the police department, unarmed, in the community. See, that's real community policing. You know, we don't need SWAT teams coming in every minute to watch people and all. But I need to get back to the original reason I wanted to call. I just wanted to share the new nonfiction book, highly researched by a great author, Cult of Glory. And it deals with the history and the development and the perfection of institutionalized racism. And it's about the Texas Rangers, and they have a 200-year anniversary coming up in 2023. And I think we need to make a big stink about that. Let everyone know what they're celebrating.
Well, the Texas Rangers, people may not realize this, They were organized, first of all, to repress the Native American nations in Texas and to deal with African Americans in those states and to deal with Hispanics in Texas and to repress
the slave
them.
State. Yeah, the slave state. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what's happening now is our awareness of these things, and we can boycott the Texas Rangers baseball team and make them change that awful name, and we can shine a light on it. Because right now, I hate to say it about human nature, it's horrendous challenges about the only thing that wakes the broader public up to actually do something. And I got another example, like the I-5 bridge, like 20 years ago, going over the Columbia River. It was closing for weeks at a time and only had maybe one lane open. So it wasn't closed. They did a lot of effort to open it up. But it wasn't until then that I saw any organized, top-down public organization and education on alternatives to going across that bridge in your car. And you know what? I would check during those 3 weeks. I would check and look at the bridge traffic, and it was way less, and it wasn't even that crowded. It wasn't even bumper to bumper. It was one lane, but they were going across and moving consistently, like, 8, 10, 20 miles an hour even sometimes. There was less traffic on the I-5 bridge than ever before. And it's because top-down education, and we got organized, and we got alternatives, including trains leaving the Amtrak station and going to Portland. Yeah, I'm just making a point about human nature, what it takes to wake people up. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it was the hoses and the dogs in Alabama on TV that woke people up. You know what I'm saying? So anyway,
True that the horrific, obvious events, murders, tortures, lynchings, all of that is unfortunately what it takes to wake up the conscience of ordinary Americans. And it shouldn't be. And people should know history, and they should be aware, and they should be empathetic, if not sympathetic, and they should look to how you can best serve the public, to protect and serve in a really meaningful way. and that is not taking people away and putting them in a prison.
No. Right. And there were no visible at the Clark County
Are you, do you have anything more to say?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, go ahead, please.
I was at the, I did finally end up at the Clark County Courthouse during the demonstration Friday, and there were no visible police around, although it would have been nice if they were there, even if they had small insignia or something and were there and had a presence. It would have been better, because at least they would have been in the crowd and listening to what was happening, and that's really what this is all about. And the only way to get past our own biases as police or just as citizens is to actually be there and listen. So anyway, I want to encourage people to get involved. Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much for the call. You know, there's another factor in all this that I don't think we can overlook. You know, I've had variations of this conversation over the past couple of weeks, of people saying, well, why now? Why is public sentiment boiling over into the streets right now instead of at some earlier point along this long continuum of violence? And part of the answer, and it would be really interesting one day to be able to see this quantified in some way, one answer is that we live in an era now where this stuff really can't transpire in silence anymore. Everybody is walking around now with a video production studio in their pocket. Everybody is walking around now with the means to document in high definition these sorts of incidents. So what we're really seeing is a situation where now all this stuff is suddenly visible, where for decades before now, it simply wasn't. And now, you know, there's example after example after example, all of it documented on cell phone video. And now
you're absolutely right. And I am, as you know, a technophobe, but this is the one really important and significant positive aspect of everybody having the ability to produce television out of their pocket.
No, it's really not just the one positive aspect, yes, but it is a positive aspect.
Well,
the internet's actually a good thing, Joe. It's actually a good thing.
We'll sometimes have to devote, when we aren't into more important things, some discussion about how the internet is controlled and who the hell runs it.
Yeah, maybe when one or two of our overlapping large-scale crises abates, maybe we can talk about that.
Yeah. I certainly would be willing to wait till something unimportant was happening.
This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. I want to take this opportunity, as we do in every one of our broadcasts, to encourage you to extend your support to this radio station. We were unable to conduct our annual spring membership drive this year because of the lockdown due to COVID-19. But we are still able to take your contributions at KBOO.FM. Just click on the donate button. We need your support. That's how this radio station stays on the air. And we do appreciate all that you bring to our conversations each and every week. So 503-231-8187 is the number to call to take part in this. Joe, I was enjoying your Portland police stories. Do you have any more?
Pardon me?
What? Do you have any more Portland police stories?
Oh, I got too many. I don't think there's my first of all, there's a conflict here within me. I'm a highly educated, very lucky, very privileged white man, and mm-hmm. in that situation, my experiences with the police, while in many cases because I'm politically active on the left, have been gross, have been wrong, and so on. But they don't compare with the ordinary situation of persons of color or persons of Hispanic origin in dealing with the police all over the United States. It can't compare, because the fact of the matter is this is still a very racist nation, and that racism is unfortunately very often embodied in law enforcement.
Yeah, I really can't argue with that. There is a dimension to all of this as well that we have touched on in today's show but haven't really dug into deeply, and I want to do that quickly now. And that is, of course, COVID-19. We were... let me just take a step back. The journal Nature, by some researchers who have looked at the sum total of social distancing measures implemented around the globe in terms of their impact on preventing cases of COVID-19. And the final analysis is that social distancing, even though it's an incredibly blunt instrument and carries with it economic hardship, has been incredibly effective around the world. We're looking at orders of magnitude fewer cases and fewer deaths in the United States because of the social distancing protocols that we implemented. And one is left wondering, had we had competent leadership at the national level, and had we been able to get out in front of this thing right away, like South Korea, for example, things could have been even better than they are, or New Zealand. Now, I'm mentioning these things in a global context because the truth is that in the global community, the United States has handled this so poorly in comparison to many, many other countries, just so, so poorly. But even still, the social distancing that we implemented had a profound effect in terms of preventing the spread of this disease. Now, we were looking at the possibility, and still are, of a resurgence in COVID-19 cases due to the premature opening of state economies that has been taking place over the past several weeks, most of these states being concentrated in the old Confederacy. So we were looking at already the possibility of a resurgence, of a second wave. Now, it has to be said that the George Floyd protests are going to exacerbate that problem. All of the images that I have seen from protests around the nation and around the world, in all of those images, I see the vast majority of people wearing face coverings, which is good. But I don't think anybody, from a layman to an epidemiologist, would say that gathering right now in the large numbers that we have seen associated with these protests is a good idea. We are going to see more COVID-19 cases because of these protests. Now, is that a justifiable price? I don't know. I don't even know if you can do that particular math. I don't know if that particular equation is even valid. I think that there's a sense of moral imperative around these protests that in most people's minds trumps the danger of exposure to COVID-19. So the discussion simply by noting that we're going to see more cases. We're going to see more cases.
Well, and the important thing about this is the clown in the White House, in order to, he thinks, to get elected, wants to have things go back to some kind of normal of his imaginings, which means people will spend a lot of money and businesses will thrive. And the fact of the matter is that when you have a virus, when you have a situation like this, you have to shelter. You have to be careful. You have to be concerned. You have to use social distance and so forth. And this clown absolutely doesn't give a damn about that. What he wants is a fictive America of 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you're already seeing him. You're already seeing the White House pivot away from the coronavirus towards something else. Did you see that spectacle of that clown the other day talking about the jobs report, which was unexpectedly good, and talking about how George Floyd was smiling down from heaven, beaming because of the great jobs numbers?
You know, that little fascist pig actually said that.
Yeah, it was another one of those absolutely jaw-dropping and astonishing moments from this guy. I could go on and on about Donald Trump's character, but you all have heard me do that too many times, so I'm not going to do that. But, you know, getting back for a moment to this study published in the journal Nature, in the United States, the social distancing measures that we implemented prevented, according to the study, as many as 60 million additional coronavirus infections and as many as 5 million deaths due to COVID-19. That is no small thing. In fact, I saw an interview with one of the authors of the study who characterized it like this: never before in human history have we seen human cooperation on this scale, and never before in human history have we seen that cooperation save so many lives. Now, that may seem like a small balm, considering the fact that we're still in the midst of an ongoing pandemic, but that is noteworthy. That is something that bodes well for the future of humanity, I think.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm really glad that study was published, and it's really important to understand that if the president of the United States had been a good, reasonable president of the United States, and I'm not talking about Democrat or Republican, doesn't matter. If he'd been a responsible, or she had been a responsible person, this whole thing would have been even less of a damaging event. And in fact, ironically, we could have resumed the economic life of the society much sooner.
Speaking of resuming things sooner, boys.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Speaking of resuming things sooner, Francis wants to join in.
Absolutely. Welcome, Francis.
Hello. Hi.
Hello. Hi.
Just on that, what you're talking about right now, I just want to make a comment that the fact that that flim-flam man is still in the White House has said more about something going on in our morally corrupt Congress than it does him. And the fact that he's still there.
Well, that's true, Francis. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the Senate totally chickened out on dealing with this fact.
Well, yeah, it's the fact that he's remains there throughout this is a reflection on our Congress. And why he's still there, I don't know. But I wanted to speak about the protests and what happened and the fact that the people have decided that the institution of racism is a much greater harmful disease than COVID and are out protesting is amazing and pretty all over the world. It is, it's impressive. And I'm very happy to see it. And when we speak about the technology that has allowed that video to be shown all over the world, the response is not surprising. Every mama in the world heard that man call out to his mom.
Yes.
Every person in the world saw how callously, calmly, in his hands in his pocket, looking like a RoboCop, that man made sure that his knee was correctly placed on George's neck. Everybody saw that. And for him to
well,
think...
Well, I want to give a shout-out. I don't actually remember her name.
For that man to think that it was okay for him to do that and that he thought he could get away with it is what people are protesting about.
And can you say that again, Francis, please? Can you say that last part again?
I'm sorry?
Can you say that last part again, please?
I said the fact that that man, that RoboCop, thought that he could get away with what he was doing is what people are protesting. The fact that our system is so corrupt that that happens all the time. And the fact that the only reason he was arrested is because there was a video. Otherwise, we don't know how many other times this has taken place. And, you know, he looked like he'd done it before. Like it was just a casual thing that he does. So the other issue that is coming up quite a bit is mass incarceration and people in prison and the fact that we need to look at another way of the entire criminal justice system being operated, and there's a lot more focus on restorative justice rather than punitive justice, and I appreciate that that's happening also.
Yes, you're right, and that could be, and I hope it will be, a very important part of the reforms, which amazingly to me, having been around a long time, looked like they may actually have enough power to change the way we think about public safety.
Exactly, and the whole criminal justice system, from the arrest point of arrest to what a man is or a person or a woman is being charged with, whether or not they even make it to the jailhouse, to the prosecution and how that's handled, and the sentencing and how that's handled, and what kind of restorative justice we could come up with other than the barbaric notion of putting people in prison. That is so barbaric, it's ridiculous that we're still doing that now. So hopefully this will generate a whole lot of discussion about the entire criminal justice system.
Well, you know,
I
hope you're right.
We already
I
know
we're all agreeing that that's the thing that needs to happen now, and we hope that it does happen. And we hope that people begin to think about public safety in terms of its various components, the least important probably being the man with a gun who arrests somebody for doing
crime. And I've had conversations with people who say, well, the police are human too. And I say, well, of course they are. And that's why no fallible human being should be given that much power over anyone else.
Agreed. Absolutely.
I'm having both. This connection is kind of strange. We don't, the feedback's really weird. But
yeah, we're all anyway, making do under a less than ideal circumstances here.
Right, exactly. Right. But I appreciate the conversation. You guys take care.
Hey.
Yeah.
Hey,
by the way,
thank you, Francis.
Yeah, I want to compliment whatever organizational structure magically has appeared around the protests in Portland and elsewhere. One of the strategies, clearly, is to gather at one location and move to, by marching, move to another location so that every part of the city can see a large crowd of people crying out for social justice. This is brilliant. This is something that I don't know why nobody thought about it a long time ago. This is progress on an intellectual and public level that has not happened in my memory.
Yeah, agreed. It feels like a phase change, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Like a fundamental reshuffling of the way people think about these things and the way people think about how they move through the world compared to the way other people are able to move through the world. It's a reckoning. It's a reckoning that is so long overdue in our society. What concerns me, though, is that like so many movements in the past, this will burn bright, it will flame out, something else will come along to arrest the public's attention, and in the end we get either superficial change that doesn't mean anything at all, or we get change that's in such a small increment that it makes not much difference at all. What we need here is sustained action and pressure over the period of many years that it's going to take to implement the sorts of large-scale changes that they're considering in Minneapolis right now.
Yeah,
it's not going to happen overnight.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that really what's most important is for people, particularly the large number of persons, of Caucasian persons in the United States, that they recognize the incredible injustice, the incredible cruelty, the incredible weight being put upon persons of color in this country from the very get-go. And it wasn't, I want to point out, it's not a skin color issue, because, for example, the Irish were, there was a great deal of prejudice against them. For
yeah, but it is, Joe, it is. It is a skin color issue. It is a skin color issue.
But now
you can talk about groups like the Irish and the Italian being persecuted when they first arrived in the United States, but that is nothing like the scope or the scale or the duration of what
I didn't mean to imply any equality there. I just wanted to use examples of disadvantage and how they are manipulated to the interests of what I believe is fundamentally a ruling class structure.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is fundamentally a ruling class structure. So what's happening now is wonderful. What's happening now is long overdue, and it gives me a great deal of hope for the future. I hope that not too many people become sick as a result of what's going on, and I hope that we're able to sustain this pressure over the long term, because that's what we're going to need to do.
Absolutely.
All right. This, again, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show on KBOO. Do we have any more callers, Sonia, standing by?
I believe, do we still have Harry?
Yeah, Harry's here.
Go ahead, you're live.
Greetings, gentlemen.
Come on, Harry.
Thank you for taking my call. What happened in Minneapolis about all the city council voting to defund the police, the reason why is they went to the police for some changes and some ideas and what they wanted, and the police union said, no, read your contract, and we have binding arbitration. So the only way to get rid of the police department is to defund it and get another one, because the police unions are so strong. I mean, look, example here in Portland. When Kendra James was killed, right. Mayor Sam Adams fired those two police officers. But binding arbitration got their jobs back. And Mayor Adams and the last two mayors also mentioned that they wanted to change that in the contract, but it never got into the contract where the mayor could fire or anyone because they work at his pleasure, and they can fire any police officer they want to. And so the police, I mean, the unions are very, very strong, and there's, you know, and they've got the city council wrapped around their finger. And that's the only way to get rid of them is to defund. And another thing about Kendra James, most people don't realize, because I'm a friend of her father, is that she had two children. So when she was killed, they took the two children. They gave one back to the family. The other one was set for adoption.
And, really?
Adoption. And now the child is probably about 12 or 13, so the family is hoping that when she turns 18, she'll try to hunt them down.
Man.
Yeah.
That's just tragic. That's
yeah, it's very, very tragic. But the police union is very strong. I don't know if you remember, 7 years ago, there was a Oregon City police officer that was killed, and they had a parade going down I-5 all the way to the convention center for a memorial and everything else. That was all paid by the Portland Police Union. So that's how strong and powerful and, you know, and politically they are. So, and one last thing about the COVID, 1,000 people are still dying a day here in the United States. By the end of this year, it'll be 300,000 people. So
that's mind-boggling, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So, and it's still going on, and there's no flu vaccination yet. So until we get one, we don't know what's going to happen. And problem is, well, there's a lot of people who refuse to take the flu shot. Well, then a few people I know.
I want to thank you. Listen, I want to get in one quick word. I want to make clear on my own behalf, but in general, what is happening with these repeated demonstrations and demands that we get justice for everybody, that we recognize the inherent injustice in the way in which